You know, it's hard to believe that two years have passed since the governor and I took office, and that this is the third time I have had the honor of introducing him to this joint assembly. These 2 years have certainly brought their share of hardships to our state, natural, economic, and otherwise. But there is no question that despite the many headwinds we have been faced, this governor has ended years of complacency in our state government and is moving Connecticut forward again. Our state is reinvigorated itself on so many levels, whether it's our approach to spurring economic growth, educating our children, or caring for the sick and the elderly. I look forward to working with him and with all of you again this session to keep the momentum going for the benefit of everyone who calls our state home. Our state just went through, and still going through, a tragedy that we never expected. I personally have privately thanked the governor for his work. Those of you that were not in attendance, those of you that had not been on the ground in Newtown, don't understand the feeling of what happened or how the governor led. There are a lot of people that we have to thank, and I know the governor's going to do that, and they all know from the bottom of my heart I thank them. But I've got to personally thank the governor for taking hold of the reins of a very, very difficult situation and helping with compassion and leadership and caring to getting people's lives hopefully back online again. So, ladies and gentlemen, I can't tell you how proud I am to introduce a man who has the compassion, who understands what vision is, who has no greater love but for this state and for the people in it, our governor, Daniel P. Malloy.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. We have work to do. Thank you. Thank you. Please. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Mr. President, Mr. Speaker, Senator McKinney, Representative Cafaro, my good friend, Lieutenant Governor Wyman, and my fellow state officials, ladies and gentlemen of the General Assembly, honored members of the judiciary, members of the clergy, and to all of the citizens of the great state of Connecticut who are watching or listening today, thank you. Thank you for the honor of inviting me into the People's House to address you. I'd also like to offer my sincere congratulations to the leadership of the Democrat and Republican caucuses in each chamber, and especially to Speaker Sharkey and Majority Leader Arasimowitz as they take on their new roles. Congratulations as well to all of the new members of the General Assembly who were sworn in earlier today. I want to say that I look forward to working with you in the months and years ahead. As we gather in this historic chamber, let us always keep in our thoughts the brave men and women of the great state of Connecticut serving in our armed forces around the globe. We thank them and our veterans for their service and sacrifice, and we pray for their continued safety and health. I'd like to recognize my wife, Kathy, and two of my sons, Daniel and Sam, who join us today. Thank you. As I know is true for so many of you, I could not possibly do my job without the tremendous love and support of my family. Finally, we are joined by two of Newtown's finest leaders, First Selectwoman Pat Lodra and School Superintendent Janet Robinson. It's an honor to have you with us today. were tested by unimaginable tragedy. Your compassion and your leadership over the past month has been an inspiration to Connecticut and to me personally. It will not surprise anyone here tonight or today that this speech is very different from the one that I first envisioned giving. In the early days of December, I began thinking about what I'd like to say today. Now, while it's only been a few short weeks on the calendar, we have all walked a very long and very dark road together. What befell Newtown is not something that we thought possible in any Connecticut beautiful small town or our cities. And yet, in the midst of one of the worst days in our history, we also saw the best of our state. Teachers and a therapist that sacrificed their lives protecting students. A principal and school psychologist that ran into harm's way. Our brave Connecticut State Troopers, Newtown's local law enforcement and firemen, and others that responded courageously when called upon. Sorry. In the aftermath, a selectwoman, a superintendent, and other local officials have served around the clock, bringing comfort and stability to Newtown. And today, Sandy Hook's teachers are doing what they do best, putting the interest of their students first as they return to classrooms, and providing stability and continuity that has never been so important and so needed as it is today. And then, of course, there are the 26 families. The families that, despite unimaginable loss, have gotten up each and every day since that happened, and have been there for one another and have supported their communities as much as those communities have supported them. They have persevered, and in that perseverance, we should all find strength. We have lifted one another up and continued carrying the spirit of our fallen heroes and our wounded families and our beautiful lost children. As a state and as a community, we will continue to do whatever we can for the families of Newtown. But we must also ask ourselves, what is our responsibility? To those we've lost, to one another, to the children, and to future generations. During this legislative session, we're going to begin to answer those questions together. Let us do everything in our power to ensure that Connecticut never again suffers a loss such as this, that we take real steps to make our kids and our communities safer. Last week, my administration announced the formation of the Sandy Hook Advisory Commission, comprised of experts in mental health, education, law enforcement, and first response. Now, we may never know what motivated the events at Sandy Hook Elementary, but that will not stop us from working to prevent future tragedies. Over the coming months, the commission will come together to make specific, actionable recommendations in areas of school safety, mental health services, and gun violence protection. This session, I know there will be others that will take action on these issues, and I applaud those efforts as well. The more resources we can bring to bear on this issue, the better. Working together, we can and will effect real change. There are some things we already know. We know that we must find ways to better respond to those with mental health needs. As a society, we have an obligation to take action in a meaningful way when a person seeks our help or demonstrates a need for it. We must balance our respect for individual rights with our obligation to provide for the greater public safety. And when it comes to preventing future acts of violence in our schools, let me say this: more guns are not the answer. Let me be very, very clear. Let me be clear. Freedom is not a handgun on the hip of every teacher, and security should not mean a guard posted outside every classroom. That is not who we are in Connecticut, and it is not who we will allow ourselves to become. We also know that this conversation must take place nationally, because as long as weapons continue to travel up and down I-95, what is available for sale in Florida can have devastating consequences here in Connecticut. There will be more to say in the weeks ahead, but let me be clear. Today, our focus will be first and foremost on protecting Connecticut families. Now, those conversations won't always be easy, but as your governor, I've learned there is no challenge we face that we can't overcome with the power of our community. Together we have come time and time again. We've done it with purpose because we know there is something bigger in this world and more important than who we are as individuals. It is our community. My friends, as we begin this legislative session, let us be guided by the devotion to the common good, by faith in each other, and by a determination to work together to make community as strong as it can possibly be in every way. Now, looking back over these past 24 months, we have faced many challenges: the largest per capita budget deficit in the nation, a struggling economy, a fractured public school system, untenable energy costs, and natural disasters the likes of which our generation had never seen. And then in December, just when we thought the worst had happened, it actually did. The people of Connecticut, the communities you represent, and all of us in this chamber, when tested, we met those challenges head on. We did as our forefathers did, as our grandparents and parents taught us to do. We dug in and we banded together. We decided to focus not on what makes us different, but on what makes us the same, our common humanity. It is this core strength and that spirit of community that brought us together to accomplish so much on behalf of the people of Connecticut. 2 years ago, we faced the single largest per capita deficit in the nation. It was a problem decades in the making. We knew that getting our fiscal house in order was critical to creating jobs. Connecticut employers needed a responsible and predictable partner in state government. We came together and passed a balanced budget. We cut more than we added in revenues. And even after revenues came in short, as they did in 31 states, we know today that our budget as enacted fixed more than 90% of the problem. And last month, Democrats and Republicans came together to make sure we close that final gap without raising taxes. Now, anyone who tells you that the budget we passed 2 years ago didn't do its job, that it didn't make real change in how we approach our finances, is simply not telling the truth. I know that many of you cast very hard votes to fix those problems. And that's the kind of resolve and leadership that we are, in fact, bringing back to Connecticut. We've made other tough decisions along the way. After years of underfunding our pensions, a $4.5 billion payment would have been required in the year 2032, more than four times what we currently pay. That payment would have been impossible. That's why last year we restructured our payments to reverse years of chronic underfunding. We're avoiding our own fiscal cliff and saving Connecticut citizens $6 billion over the next 20 years. We didn't kick the can down the road, we picked it up. Then, through a restructured benefits and pension agreement with our public employees, we're saving the state approximately $20 billion. And we made sure that state government tightened its own belt as well. We shrank the number of state agencies by more than 25%. We trimmed executive branch employees by more than 1,200 positions over the past 2 years, including more than a 10% reduction in the number of state managers. As we've done more with less, so have our hardworking state employees. They've adapted and found new ways to continue providing critical services to state residents. We have all had to buckle down and make tough choices, and we're going to have to make more of them in the weeks and months to come. Now, recently, there has been a national conversation about economic development, about whether it makes any sense to have states competing against one another for jobs. It is a good conversation to have, and it's the right time to have it. But a dialogue on the best way forward cannot be an excuse for standing still. We see too much of that in Washington. I firmly believe, that we, each one of us in this chamber, must approach this session with a core guiding principle. Until every person in our state who wants a job can find one, we have more work to do. We cannot stick our heads in the sand or simply hope for the best, not when other states are actively recruiting jobs from every corner of the globe, jobs that can and should come to Connecticut. We must compete for every single job. With that mindset, we've begun to tackle the challenges of economic development in a holistic way in our state. Our First Five program, along with the addition of Jackson Laboratories, has leveraged a $180 million commitment in public funding to drive more than $2 billion in private investment. That same program made it possible for Connecticut to bring two Fortune 500 companies to our state. Now, the last time that we talked about two Fortune 500 companies was in 2006, and that was because they were leaving. On main streets across Connecticut, the Small Business Express program is giving local employers the chance to expand and create jobs. It was because of this program that Bevan Brothers Manufacturing in East Hampton was able to rebuild after a fire ravaged their historic Bell factory. They purchased new equipment and got their employees back to work because of that program. Just a few months ago, I announced the third plank of our economic development strategy, an innovation ecosystem. The program has one goal, and that is connecting people with good and great ideas with capital investors. It will create new high-skilled jobs, jobs with good wages, and jobs with good benefits in our state of Connecticut. Now, we're off to a good start, but it is only a start. The key is making government an active partner rather than a bystander who watches markets develop elsewhere. By investing in growth industries like bioscience and digital media, by recruiting companies like Jackson Laboratories and NBC Sports, and by standing with our small businesses and our startups, we are taking steps to make sure that Connecticut leads again. When it came to education, the stakes were clear. Take action together, or risk losing an entire generation of young people to failing schools and a widening achievement gap. I am proud that after a long and hard debate, we were able to say with one voice that the status quo was no longer acceptable, that when it comes to public education, we can't keep doing what we've always done and simply hope for better results, that our kids can't afford it and our state cannot afford it as well. We worked with an eye towards the future and made an historic investment of nearly $100 million from pre-K to high school, focusing on districts that we know are most in need. Now, reaching kids early is critical to that success, and early childhood education had to be a central portion of our education reform. So we created 1,000 new school readiness openings statewide for youngsters at a time when no one thought that that was possible. That's 1,000 more children that will show up to kindergarten this fall, day one, ready to learn. We did that together, and we will do more. To combat an unacceptable achievement gap, we've begun transforming underperforming schools through the newly created Commissioners Network. Four schools have already volunteered and are benefiting from intensive intervention, increased instruction time, and improved collaboration among teachers and administrators. Now, I have visited these four schools in Bridgeport, Hartford, New Haven, and Norwich, and each exhibits a new energy and renewed sense of purpose, and more schools are lining up to be transformed in the years ahead. Of course, reform could not be complete without supporting our teachers. They have dedicated their lives to our children, and for the first time in a very long time, we're dedicating new resources for them as well. We know success is possible. We have seen it. With a cooperative effort where every voice is heard, we're going to replicate it in classrooms around our state. The bottom line is that students are going to be better prepared for school today and for the job market tomorrow. When it came to energy, our state had been a national leader for years in the worst possible way. We had the highest electric rates in the continental United States, rates that were squeezing the budgets of families and businesses. We came together. We decided we needed a plan to take these problems head on. We realized that our economic, energy, and our environmental, energy, and economic needs were all related, and that the path we chose would impact our economy in this state for years to come. We consolidated state agencies to better coordinate our energy functions. We strengthened programs promoting renewable power and energy efficiency. We're leveraging private capital to deliver renewable energy at a price lower than almost anywhere else in the United States. Today, we've seen electric rates drop in Connecticut by 12% across the board. But we cannot stop now. The comprehensive energy strategy that my administration announced this past October shows us the way forward. Together, we will expand cheaper, cleaner, and more reliable energy choices for consumers, enhancing efficiency programs for all communities, at the same time helping to create thousands of new jobs, putting Connecticut businesses and consumers in control of their energy future will have a real and immediate impact. You need look no further than Modern Woodcrafts, a locally owned company in Plainville. They invested in the kind of energy incentives that our state plan will promote. They're seeing more than a $35,000 savings per year in energy costs. Or you could look at Woodbridge, where Amity High School will have an annual budget savings of $120,000, more than the salary of two teachers, after the town made a conversion to natural gas. Across Connecticut, we are taking control of our energy future for the first time. High energy prices, struggling schools, a broken budget, a sluggish economy, all problems that every person in this room knew that we were facing 2 years ago, and we have faced them together. One challenge we didn't see coming. In 2011, Connecticut was rocked by the worst winter in our history. Two storms packing a 1-2 punch, the likes of which we hadn't seen in our state in more than 25 years. Tropical Storm Irene and the October nor'easter revealed holes in our emergency response system that should have been addressed years, if not decades, ago. It was a wake-up call, and we woke up. We put in place new procedures to better coordinate emergency response infrastructure. We commissioned a two-storm panel to investigate exactly what went wrong and to determine what needed to be done to prevent unacceptable power and communication disruptions. The panel led directly to the passage of tough new laws, laws that hold Connecticut utility companies accountable for how they respond to emergencies. And we created a new energy microgrid program to increase energy reliability in critical areas. Now, these weren't quick fixes or window dressing. They were the result of saying that we had had enough and it was time for us to do more. What does it all mean for Connecticut residents? We know that we will again feel the brunt of bad weather. But we can tell our citizens that the state is more prepared for future challenges, that their families will be safer when a disaster strikes, and that the odds of anyone having to needlessly suffer through prolonged power outages have been greatly diminished. When Hurricane Sandy struck, we saw the results of the work that we had done together. While we can never entirely prevent damage or power outages, the response was, in fact, better and faster. Once again, we saw a problem, and together, we work to address it. If these past 2 years have proven anything, it's that we have the ability to rally around a common good and a common goal. We've done it in a way that just doesn't seem possible these days in some places, and certainly not in Washington, D.C. In December, at the same time that leadership from each of your caucuses was meeting with my team for long hours, night after night, to develop a mitigation plan, our national budget was being driven to and then off a fiscal cliff. While we've worked to manage our state's finances, national inaction hangs like a dark cloud over our state budget. For the many Connecticut families with someone working in our defense industry, Washington's inability to address problems on a reasonable deadline is causing sleepless nights, and it is unnecessary. And earlier this month, while many families and small businesses were still working to recover from Hurricane Sandy, the gears once again ground to a halt, slowing the process of getting aid to those who needed it most. And that is unacceptable. Now, I say this not to demean any of our colleagues in Washington, but in the hope that we will better appreciate what we have accomplished here in Connecticut. 2 years ago, you first welcomed me into this chamber. I spoke then about the challenges we faced and about the opportunities that we knew were within our grasp. I spoke about who we are as a community, about the ingenuity, the resolve, and the resilience that has defined Connecticut for centuries, about Eli Whitney and Prudence Crandall and Harriet Beecher Stowe, about a history of overcoming challenges together. My friends, that is still who we are today. We have come a long way in 2 years, and we've done it together as a government, as a community, as a state. So in 2013, let us honor one another. Let us honor our renewed community, and let us honor those we've lost. We have a great deal of work to do, but if history is any judge, we will rise to the occasion. When called upon, we will answer, as we have done time and time again, as one people, one community, and one Connecticut. So as we begin our work, which will take many months to complete, may God bless each and every one of you. May God bless the great state of Connecticut, and may God bless the United States of America. Thank you.